I think we're going to have both centralized and decentralized ways of computing. I mean, for the sake of humanity, I hope we have decentralized, right? I want to be able to own my own data, right? And I don't want this data to be used, you know, to sell me things. 100%. I want it to be used to be helpful.
You're listening to CoinDesk's Money Reimagined with Michael Casey and Sheila Warren.
Hello and welcome to Money Reimagined. I'm Michael Casey and I'm here with my co-host Sheila Warren. Happy to say that because last week I wasn't able to be here. I was busy on the book tour, which of course is yet another opportunity for me to shill the book. Yes, apologies, folks. This is what an author does at this time. My new book with Frank H. McCourt is Our Biggest Fight, Reclaiming Liberty, Humanity, and Dignity in the Digital Age. Really love you to check it out. I think it's pertinent to lots of people who are interested in decentralized systems and what went wrong with the internet when we kind of resorted to a centralized system. That, of course, is a theme that we come to regularly, and it is one that we here on the Money Reimagined podcast, on which you, of course, can get to every week on the CoinDesk Podcast Network or on Apple, Spotify, or a preferred podcast platform. It's a topic we deal with a lot, and this week, in fact, I think we have a very interesting way to think about this because we are joined by none other than Kathy Hackle, who is a renowned global executive, tech futurist, and media figure. She's the co-founder of Journey, an expert in emerging technologies providing strategic advice on gaming, AI, spatial computing, metaverse, Web3, and virtual worlds. She works with companies, brands, and governments on all of these issues, which really do go to the heart of what a decentralized internet will look like. Before we bring Kathy in, Sheila, you know, how are things?
Yeah, well, things are good. I'm battling a bad cold, but I'm excited to talk metaverses. Before I left the forum, of course, I oversaw all the things you just mentioned: AI, spatial computing, obviously blockchain, and metaverses. And it's a term that is not deployed as much. We still hear a ton about, you know, spatial computing. We hear about AI, of course. I mean, you can't even turn a corner without hearing about AI. The ads, especially for Bitcoin ETFs, are all over the place as well. I was in New York recently, and I kept turning around and running into a different ETF, big giant billboard or poster. But metaverses that's not something that folks are talking about as much, but they're still very alive. That's still a very active sphere. And I'm really eager to kind of hear from our expert guest about just, you know, what's going on? Like, what's going on with the metaverse?
Yeah, and like, who better than the godmother? Godmother, where did that word come from? Godmother of the metaverse, Kathy Hackle. Okay, that's the very first question, Kathy. But by the way, welcome to Money Reimagined. Why the name? What? Where does the godmother? What did you do to earn this?
What did I do to earn that? I'll tell you. It kind of happened by chance. It happened on Twitter, now X, right? Mm-hmm. A couple of years ago, Alexis Ohanian was tweeting asking about more women in Web3 and metaverse that he should follow. And my dear friend Andrew Schwartz, who works at Nike's metaverse team, tweeted at him a couple of names, and then he tweeted one last tweet, and he said, "Oh, and don't forget to follow Kathy Hackle, comma, she's the godmother of the metaverse." So after that, it just took on a life of its own. People took screenshots, and then just people started using it. So I'm popularly known in tech circles as the godmother of the metaverse. I think it also comes from the fact that I've been in immersive industries and in the tech space for over a decade, kind of really, you know, pushing a lot on virtual worlds, on gaming, on immersive content and everything that's been happening. So I've been working in the trenches, not just from theory, for quite a while. So yeah, so that's kind of how it came about.
Well, that sounds pretty good. And of course, it's worth noting that there is also the godfather of the metaverse, none other than Neil Stephenson, the author who sort of really conceived of it as a imaginary concept in Snow Crash, his tremendous science fiction novel, and was a speaker like you at Consensus. So, you know, we've had him there. So
I love Neil. I think he's fantastic. I really like the things that he's doing. I'm sure we're going to talk about that as well.
Right.
But I really appreciate his vision for the future.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the two of you, like, you know, stewards, parents of the metaverse, you have a lot of responsibility. So on that though, talking about responsibilities and where things have gone and going, like the last time we met and chatted was the hype moment for metaverse, right? At that point, you know, Facebook had changed its name to Meta, and you know, Zuck was just saying that they're just pouring all of their investment into this. Weirdly, that was pre-AI, and now it's all in AI, right?
That's all AI, yeah.
You know, I've often thought that these moments in buzzwordy type trends within tech and Silicon Valley are just really stupid because, you know, it's not as if the metaverse has stopped being a thing, like, or that these concepts that we're talking about, you know, these immersive world experiences and all the other bits and pieces that come with, like, a sort of a more decentralized web that are part of that as well. People are still building all that sort of stuff, right? It's just not a buzzword in the same way that Web3 apparently is not the buzzword. It's AI that's the buzzword now. When in fact, I keep saying repeatedly that they're two sides of the same coin, basically. And you know, we really just need to, like, step back and stop just getting carried away by this. Whereas nonetheless, the fact that we did go through something of a cycle, right? It was all the buzz, and now it's not. What happened? And where are things going with the metaverse or metaverses or a metaverse or whatever we should be saying?
Well, it's been a wild ride. And I think the metaverse, you know, as the godmother of the metaverse, at some point I was like, well, what am I godmothering here? Like, because it's you know, people started not wanting to say the word. Like, it became like a bad word, right? So people are like, oh, don't say that word. Or you, like, you start crypto? To see this. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Just, you don't say NFT, right? So definitely, I think metaverse as a term, right, was a victim of its own hype, right? And I benefited from the hype. I'm the first one to tell you. Yeah, of course. Like, I, you know, but I still believe in the things that I said. I still believe in the things that I spoke about when it came to what this is, right? So in the current state, 2024, right, of the metaverse, it's still being worked on. People are still building lowercase metaverses towards a uppercase metaverse. They might not be using the term metaverse, right? But they're still building things. And I'll give you an example. And I think this is a great example. I remember, I think it was 2022 or 2023, when there was a big headline, like, Disney kills their metaverse team and they fired all their metaverse people. And when I talked to media, I said, well, they're firing that team, but it doesn't mean that they're not working on this stuff. They have tons of Imagineers and other people working on other things, you know, at ILMX labs and things like that. They haven't stopped working on it. They might not be using the term metaverse, right? And then lo and behold, you hear the news of, you know, Disney investing, what is it, $1.5 billion in Epic Games and making a universe. Like, they did not want to use the word metaverse. That was very clear, right? But it's still their focus on virtual worlds, on moving forward with metaverse, right? So maybe for those of the folks listening here that, you know, might not have, you know, gotten a definition of metaverse or something, there's some great definitions out there. Matthew Ball has a really great one. I don't know it by heart, but it's a really good one. In my perspective, as someone that has been observing this both from a software and hardware perspective, I see the metaverse about it all being about virtual shared experiences that happen both in virtual spaces, right, like Fortnite, but will also happen in the physical world. Just the physical world side of it hasn't been fully enabled. That is where I think things are going to get really interesting in our conversation, that other part, right? And to me, it has always been the successor state to today's mobile internet, right? Every time I've done a talk, I've always said those things, and I stand by those things. Whether we call it metaverse or not, that is a different question. And I think there's a term that's coming up that a lot more people are interested in using, because I think it has maybe potentially less baggage.
What is that term? I must ask.
So I think you're going to start to see people move, or they're already seeing it, people move away from the word metaverse, right, because of the baggage it carries, and using more spatial web, spatial internet, an expansion of the web, right, that expands into the physical world, that makes any interface, you know, any interface in the physical world, you know, an interface where you can put content, virtual content. So I think you're going to start to see that. And that, I think, comes at this moment when you've got AI, Sheila, like you mentioned, it's everywhere. Like, I can't go anywhere and I cannot do any interview without talking about AI. It's like everywhere. Like, even my kids are talking about it, right? So we arrive at this moment with generative AI kind of really revolutionizing everything at record speed, right? And right behind it, you've got spatial computing, right? You know, Apple Vision Pro and Apple talking about spatial computers and, you know, Meta talking about new glasses and, like, all this, you know, the R1 Rabbit, the Humane AI Pin. You've got this moment, right, where you've got generative AI large language models, full speed ahead, crazy valuations, crazy investments, right? Every single shareholder's call, it's like AI, AI. It feels like a little bit like metaverse a couple years ago, right? And then you've got this kind of like thing over here, spatial computing, kind of starting to seep into the vocabulary very slowly. And for me, what I'm starting to see is that people are starting to talk about the expansion of the internet, the evolution of the internet as the spatial web, right? Which in essence is about virtual shared experiences that happen both in virtual, you know, virtual spaces, but will also happen in the physical world, which is where the bigger transformation will happen. So that's where I think we arrive at this moment. And yeah, I think it's we would not be here if it weren't for the convergence of gaming, Generation Alpha, spatial computing, and AI just kind of like coming all together in this crazy moment. And obviously everything that's happening, you know, with Bitcoin and you know, and the ETFs and all these sorts of things that are, it's just this crazy moment of convergence that I don't think we've seen in a long time, at least at the speed that we're seeing it right now.
So at the World Economic Forum, we called this the fourth industrial revolution, right? And that was kind of one of the early terms around this concept that we were going to have, we were already starting to have a meeting, if you will, convergence between our online and offline worlds, our physical and digital worlds. And I tell a story a lot about watching my daughter during the pandemic playing a game with her friend while FaceTiming her friend on her iPad. So they're talking, like their physical, if you will, self. They're talking to each other with their images, and then they're bopping around in their game. And it was so funny watching how fluidly they would talk to each other, like what we're doing right now. They'd be typing with their avatars, like in their game, right? And those were just very seamless things for them. And I'd known all of this because, I mean, I've been in tech for a long time and I've been in the Valley for a long time, et cetera. But just seeing that and seeing how at the time she was like 7, I think, it was just wild. It was wild. And so I think to me, when I think about all of this, it really is, there's a couple of things that maybe our listeners will understand, right? So if you haven't read Snow Crash, if you haven't read Ready Player One, if you haven't read these kind of early seminal from the 80s books that laid out a vision around how we were all, that all was kind of focused on gaming and on games, right? That was definitely where it was focused. But it was this idea that you're going to have these digital impulses or digital moments that were going to have real world consequences, right? And no more is that clear, I think, than in Ready Player One. But now with the advent of augmented reality, which was actually the Hollywood version of that was Minority Report. I always go back to that. A lot of folks saw that movie, right? So the idea that as you're walking through the world, you have some sort of device or a chip or whatever it winds up looking like, it will shrink, I think, over time, the way that our phones were giant and then became small. You have a device that is actually showing you images overlaid over whatever you're walking through. Now in Minority Report, it was a hellscape. Whereas Tom Cruise is walking through this mall or whatever it is, there's just ads coming at him, right? Like robot, like all of this stuff, like buy this thing, do this thing, what have you, which is like the dystopian view. But in a more, I don't want to call it utopian, a more practical view, perhaps, you'd have things like map overlays. Yeah. You'd have things like, hey, you stopped in there. Your friend is here. They can say hi to you, whatever it is. You'd have these kinds of experiences that were more desirable to you than an ad like jamming into your visual field. You'd have this ability to use that overlay to make decisions. And all of us are doing this in a cruder way today. If you use GPS, if you have a map that's showing in your car on your screen, right? You're having to like look at the map and then look up, but that is actually helping you decide like where to turn, where to go, you know, what to do. And more, there actually is an AI behind that, analyzing traffic patterns, creating a new route for you. All of this is already happening. It's just still, it's a little bit like we feel like we're using the tool and it's becoming more and more, that will become more and more seamless.
I will say, though, also on social media, we are getting bombarded with ads in ways that I've just taken to it and another level. But that's, it's like two sides of the same coin. But anyway, sorry, carry on, Sheila.
Yes. Well, you know, Brian Bellendorf always says, like, well, you know, if only we'd made a couple of different critical decisions would have resulted in far less spam, no banners, no, you know, a couple of these key moments along the way would have resulted in a better, I think, an objectively better experience, certainly around ads than anybody actually wants. But again, if you imagine that an AI is going to get better and better at predictive analysis around the things that are useful to you in real time as you're walking through the world. Now, look, to some people, no matter how you spin it, this is going to sound like an absolute disastrous nightmare from hell. Okay, like for
nightmare
sure.
Fuel, yeah, for many. Nightmare. I agree.
And I think that is not an unfair assessment because as we've seen, these things can spin out of control pretty quickly. But for many, it's actually, there's a, not just a convenience factor, but a true augmentation of your reality, which is what AR stands for, augmented reality, in ways that actually will be quite desirable, particularly if you can make a decision. This goes back to the episode we had with Chris Dixon on Web3. If you can make a decision about the use of your data to generate that reality for you, right? If that is the truth behind this, and Michael, this goes to your book as well. If that is how data is being used, that is very different than if data is being used by a third party advertiser or whatever to shove things into your face, right? So Kathy, I'm just curious, how do you see the human element in all of this being preserved? And are we seeing the metaverse, the spatial web, which I like that term much better, is that being crafted around humans at the center, or is it actually being crafted around Gen AI and AI, which is still based on human data, right? But it's a different thing.
So yes and no. The answer is yes and no, right? Before I answer your question, I will say this. You mentioned a couple of books. I think I need to mention, I need to kind of just kind of give mad respect to a sci-fi author that I think a lot of people don't mention, but Werner Vinge, who just passed away, his book Rainbow's End. Like Rainbow's End is a great sci-fi, mind you, example of what that future spatial web metaverse in the physical world could be, right? If anyone that reads that book will definitely get it. And I think it's a recommended reading, just like Snow Crash, just like the other ones as well, tend to be a little bit more VR, right? But this one, really, I think Rainbow's End, it's like fantastic. And, you know, rest in peace. Huge Werner Vinge fan. So to your question, Sheila. I think some people are designing this future and these, you know, the spatial web with humans in mind. Others are just focused on making money and AI. And here's what I'm seeing, because this is what I'm seeing from the work I'm doing and everything, is right now we're at this moment, right, where everyone's super hyper focused on large language models, and rightfully so. Like, it's revolutionized stuff. It's insane, right? The moment that we're going through. I'm looking at what comes after large language models. If we come to the realization that large language models are trained on things of the past, right? Things that have been written, pictures that have been taken, even Sora, right? Which I think OpenAI said is a world building model. Like, in my perspective, it doesn't necessarily mean it's a world building model. It's trained on videos of the past. Where it starts to get interesting and potentially nightmare fuelish, in like you're mentioning, is when you start to see the evolution from large language models to large vision models or large visual models. The only way to get these large vision models is through hardware. That's why you're starting to see this race from VC capital going into hardware. That's why Apple, that's why Meta, that's why Castle Ventures is investing in Rabbit R1. That's why Johnny Ive and Sam Altman are thinking of hardware. That's why there's this mad rush that you're going to see over the next 6 to 12, 18 months on new hardware propositions, because everyone's going to try to get access to that real-time data to train these models on the physical world. And the only way for autonomous vehicles, for robots, for virtual beings, for these assets, these annotations and holograms that you mentioned that can help us make decisions, the only way for those to actually be helpful is for the AI to be able to see, right? I don't hear a lot of people talking about AI that can see. That is a huge transformation for humanity, huge transformation for human-computer interaction. Once AI can see, once AI has perspective, once AI can execute, once AI can truly become helpful in the physical world, that is a totally different paradigm on how we engage with technology. And that's the moment we arrive in with spatial computing.
Can you tie that back to the machinery part of it? Because I think it's actually just really critical, right? Like now, the hardware, this is why NVIDIA's share price is through the roof, right?
They're the only ones who are able to see. I was like, I get exactly what they're doing here.
Right. I personally am very interested in the idea that the software and the algorithms that are being created to run LLMs and to train them is going to hopefully be designed in such a way that that there's a more commoditized version of that technology that would actually enable a decentralized LLM structure to emerge, so that you don't get these gigantic behemoths, the only ones able to run this. But you're talking about AI being useful in all of that. Can you explain that a little bit more? Like, how, so it can see, it has these, how does that make the whole rendering process? And Matthew Ball's discussion about rendering in his book, I thought was really good. Mm-hmm. You have to understand the physics of what's necessary, right?
The power that you need to do this, right? So let me just step back. And for example, like I've got the Apple Vision Pro here. I'm a developer.
Oh, please put it on because that'll be cool.
Mess up my makeup.
Yeah, do it. Love it.
But yeah, I've got it here. I'm an Apple Vision Pro developer. I'm working on a lot of really interesting experiences. I'm starting to look at large vision models and kind of what's happening in that space. This device, even though people are claiming Apple's behind on AI, they might be behind on some generative AI stuff. They're going to catch up. They have been ahead of the game when it comes to computer vision.
Hmm.
Like this device right here has so much AI computer vision in it.
Hmm.
It's got, 12, 13 cameras that are literally scanning the physical world every time I use it. Everything gets placed perfectly. The hand tracking is seamless, right? There's so much power in this device. And it's reading my physical world on a constant basis, right? It's getting real-time data of everything that's around me. Our phones can do that, but our phone's camera is limited in some ways. This is actually, scanning everything around me on a constant basis, right? So that's what I mean. Like once you start to get more hardware, like Humane AI Pin, for example, I got a demo at Mobile World Congress, has vision now. It's not, I don't know if it's available to everyone, but they're introducing vision. The R1 Rabbit has a camera. It's going to be able to see. Like anything that Meta comes up with, any other device that Sony or Samsung bring, they're all going to be devices that can see the physical world and understand the physical world, because that's the only way that AI can build world-building models based on the physical world, not based on a YouTube video, right? So that's where I think it starts getting really interesting, because it's actually going to map the physical world. And you can look at the work, for example, Niantic has done, or NVIDIA mentioning that they're doing a virtual twin of the Earth. Like that is all aligned to that expansion of computing into any surface. Any surface becomes a spatial interface, right? So that's where it gets really exciting, because it could be very useful as humans, to be able to kind of make these decisions, like you mentioned, Sheila. On the other hand, so if the people that are designing for humans are thinking of how can I make this useful for people, the people that might not be thinking about that might be thinking more of like, how do I make a buck with this? Are thinking more of like, how do I make everything within eyesight and earshot? Don't forget the audio part of someone's world, physical world, real estate. That's where virtual air rights, which is something that keeps me up at night. And keeps me up at night. I think about that. Like if everything becomes within eyesight and earshot of me, becomes real estate, what does that mean for constituents? Like, I live in DC. I talk to politicians. I'm like, this is something that's coming. What does that do for your reality, right? Your idea of reality. I balance the good with the bad. I feel like an eventual device that allows us to have compute power and communication and convenience all in one is fantastic. I'd rather have that than have to be looking down on my phone or telling my kids to stop looking at their phones, right? But then on the other side, it's like the trade-off, if you have these devices that are constantly reading the physical world, understanding the physical world, what does that do and how could that be used negatively? Which is where virtual air rights comes in.
I'm excited to share with you that our biggest fight, Reclaiming Liberty, Humanity, and Dignity in the Digital Age, a book I co-authored with Project Liberty founder Frank McCourt, will be released on March 12 and is now available for pre-order. Our biggest fight is a manifesto on the need to fix a severely broken internet with a set of workable solutions for all of us to follow. It's a hopeful book, exploring the big opportunities for innovation and prosperity that technology can bring if it's designed with humans in mind. But it's also an urgent call to action. We must get this right for society now, before it's too late. Find the link to the book in the show notes. Global crypto regulation, the disruptive power of AI, the rise of tokenization. Consensus is the one event where experts in digital assets, blockchain, and related topics convene to talk about the ideas shaping our digital future. Join developers, investors, founders, brands, policymakers, and plenty more in Austin, Texas from May 29 to 31. The 10th annual Consensus is curated by CoinDesk to feature the industry's most sought-after speakers, unparalleled networking opportunities, and unforgettable experiences. Take 15% off registration with the code MRP15. Register now at consensus.coindesk.com.
Well, as somebody living in San Francisco, I mean, like, you know, it's so funny to me how most of my friends anywhere else in the world, frankly, but certainly in the country, have no idea. Like, they're not used to driverless cars, right? Whereas they're just daily, it's really not a big deal. And what they have that's so interesting is cameras that are constantly rotating. Like, it's actually, they're so funny looking because on the top of the car, but also on all the sides of the car, there's just a spinning camera that's going all the time. Mm-hmm. And what I think is so fascinating is that that technology basically, and I'm not saying it was this literal, but brought to a person and scanning the world in the same way. It's what makes a driverless car safe. And I'll put that in slight air quotes because it's, you know, depends.
No, but I'm still not there.
I'm not completely concerned.
Statistically, maybe. I don't know.
I'm actually at this point, I've come around to be more concerned about drivers on their phones not paying attention than driverless car, to be perfectly frank. Mm-hmm. And in San Francisco, the road accidents have been far more that scenario than driverless cars because, again, they're just commonplace, ubiquitous here. Regardless, the idea that what is happening is that data, you can parse it. Now, what is different about the driverless car model, which I think is very easy for people to understand, the amount of information you have to be able to drive a car without a human down a street and not crash into something or, you know, to obey traffic laws, all of that is very complicated. But to be able to do that and then to have seamless haptics is remarkable, right? Because I think a lot of people remember like the early Nintendo Wii, you know, you put this thing on your hand, you kind of waved it around. Sometimes it caught where you were, sometimes it didn't, sometimes it was way off, you know, what have you. Or even like earlier than that, just using a joystick to move around in the world. But now to be able to seamlessly have this haptic without a full bodysuit, right? Because in Hollywood, they were doing this forever. You had like green screen, you had a person wearing this suit and it had multiple points on it. And you were able to transfer that into the screen, right? Into the movie. But now to do that with just a device that is literally sitting as you showed it, that is just incredibly remarkable technology that's happened in a very fast amount of time. Like, it's happened very, very quickly. And so I guess, I don't know if I have a question here. It's more just kind of a wow moment, right? Because when you imagine that shrinking down even more, that you'd be able to contain that amount of information, gather and contain that kind of information in a device that's even smaller than the one you just showed us, that is a pretty wild state of affairs. So
it changes human-to-human communications, but also changes human-computer interaction. And that's, and I'll tell you, one of my pet peeves, to be honest, is when I hear someone say spatial computing equals mixed reality. I'm like, if you're saying that, you're being reductive. You're not understanding that we're talking about a new form of computing, an expansion of computing. So the way I define it, and I've written for the Harvard Business Review on this, I wrote their first spatial computing article. So I feel very, very proud that they asked me to do that. I said, spatial computing is an evolving form of 3D-centric computing that at its core uses AI, computer vision, and extended reality to seamlessly blend virtual content into someone's experience of the physical world, right? It is gonna change human-to-human communication, just like our mobile phones did. And it is going to change human-computer interaction because you're going to have the cars, the robots, the virtual beings navigating the world alongside us. Right. And I think that is extremely powerful. And the other thing I think to mention when it comes to spatial computing is to frame it in a way that people understand it. And here's where I'm going to go. So I'm not going to talk about mainframe computing because like that's not necessarily where I want to go. I want to go to desktop computing, personal computing. Right. When we all got computers on our desks, whether it was at home, whether it was at the library, whether it was college, whether it was, you know, at work, we were able to kind of compute on our desks, right? It doesn't mean that everyone had a computer at home, right? But personal computing, desktop computing, right? That gave us the internet, really everyone being able to do AOL and ICQ and all these old things, right? So then you have mobile computing, right? Where the devices come with us. They go everywhere with us. And we have mobile computing that allows us to always be connected on the go, to be able to play mobile games, AR games, like all these sorts of things, right? What you have right now is that change. And at Consensus last year, I talked about the post-smartphone future. What you have right now is this moment that is being catapulted by this moment in AI. And I say, to me, AI is revolutionary. Spatial computing is evolutionary. We're still not there yet. With spatial computing, what you have is an expansion of computing where our devices basically start to understand the physical world around us. So it's less about us adapting to the device, but more about the devices adapting to our physical world. And that's what the Vision Pro proves with the tracking. It's seamless for you to understand how to use this device, right? And you've got also, with the expansion of computing that allows any interface surface to become a spatial interface, right? With that, you also have the expansion of the web. right? Where it is more 3D centric, where it starts to be brought into the physical world, where the internet expands and breaks free of the screens in our, you know, in our computers and our walls. So that is the moment we arrive in, right? So where does the metaverse feel in all that? Is we've been working towards the metaverse, and the metaverse, like I said, is about virtual shared experiences that happen in virtual spaces, right? But also the physical world, and that hasn't been fully enabled. It is being enabled right now through AI, through computer vision, through spatial computing, and everything that's happening here with large language models and their evolution into large vision models, right? Because when you actually get AI that can understand the world, that can truly help you, that can truly execute, that can do the things, Sheila, that you mentioned, right? That's great. So we basically arrive at this moment in the convergence of AI and spatial computing, expansion of computing. Like, it's truly transformational. Just like mobile computing was transformational for all of us, this is about to happen again.
Yeah, Kathy, this is like just my mind spinning with thoughts here. I'm really glad that you used that analogy of the journey from desktop computing to mobile. Because there's something else that happened either maybe before mobile, but it certainly became a bigger part, and that is cloud computing. So, which actually reversed something of the trend that you were talking about, at least in part, right? It's not, you know, you were saying we could now do compute on our own, ourselves, at the edges, so to speak. But with the cloud and the efficiencies that that enabled for, you know, the sort of expansion of the internet, we just pushed it all back to the center. And in fact, as we all know, it is a major factor in the dominance and the emergence of these big platforms. So now as we enter into an age of AI and this question about who owns the metaverse, right? Are you talking about a world, right, where we're now walking around with our, you know, Apple Vision Pro and we are doing the recording and we're back there? I'm still worried that that's still Apple with its cloud infrastructure taking it all in, and the metaverse will be owned by Apple and, of course, by Meta and Google and others, as opposed to this collective decentralized, you know, internet metaverse that we're talking about, right? Which is the core theme when you're coming at it from a crypto perspective that we want to address. So can you square that circle? Like, how do we, you know, I think it's just like a fundamental question about what in fact is a safe future for us to live in as human beings. And I do not believe, having just written a book about this, that, and by the way, we need to get to your books because you've got one coming in, everyone. So please do not let us forget to get your book shilled as well. But it's about, you know, this internet that we created that has these centralized entities. And part of it is because we couldn't, it just became so much more efficient for the compute to be done by them. Can we do this massive thing that Matthew Ball tells us is an enormous amount of computation to create that world in a decentralized way? Is that going to be possible?
I think we're going to have both centralized and decentralized ways of computing. I mean, for the sake of humanity, I hope we have decentralized, right? I want to be able to own my own data, right? And I don't want this data to be used, you know, to sell me things. 100%. I want it to be used to be helpful, right? Mm. So to that point, but I do think, I mean, there will be walled gardens. And I've said this before, I think in that future, in that spatial web metaverse, there will be walled gardens, but there will also be open spaces, right? And everyone will choose whether they go between this, you know, this one or that one, or, you know, I don't necessarily think everyone's going to open up everything, like the shareholders. I don't think that that's something that they necessarily want, right? At the end of the day, the corporations are beholden to the shareholders, right? So I think that as much as people want to think that, you know, a corporation wants to help humanity, at the end of the day, they want to make money for their shareholders. So I think we need to be realistic. I think your point on cloud computing is incredibly important, because when you're talking about millions, if not billions of people wearing devices, like maybe not the Apple Vision Pro, but an Apple Vision version, Apple Vision Pro version 3, or mobile phones like an iPhone 16 or 17 that might have more spatial capabilities. You know, you're talking about millions, if not billions of people starting to need more and more computing. So that's where cloud computing comes into play. That's where the telcos, with more than 5G, 6G we're talking about, are going to come into play, right? Depending on if it's an at-home experience, if it's, you know, an out-of-home experience, where, you know, the signal might be coming from, where the rendering happens. Like, we're talking about compute power and connectivity at levels we have never seen. So when I talk about spatial computing, I always break it down into four components. I say there's the hardware, which everyone is focused on right now. Everyone's obsessed with the hardware. It's rightfully so. We're humans. We love hardware. Software, right? The software and everything that's happening with game engines and large language models and large vision models and all the things that are happening there, right? Then there's the connectivity that is both cloud, telco, like anything that telcos, like all these sorts of, like I would say, Wi-Fi, 5G, cloud computing, edge computing, like all the things that are going to be needed for these devices to truly work, right? And then the data, like the amount of data that is going to be created is insane, right? Yeah. And here's another reason that it is really interesting, because Amy Webb at South by Southwest put it really nicely. She said, at some point, AI and these LLMs are going to run out of data to read from the internet or wherever, right? Where is the next
apparently trove? Quite close to it already from what some people are saying.
Like, quite close. So where is the next trove of data? Where's the next gold mine going to come? It is going to come from these devices reading the physical world on a constant basis. So this is, when people think spatial computing or expansion of computing, there's a role to play for hardware, for software, for connectivity, and for data. That's where it starts to get very, very interesting. So cloud computing is still going to play a huge part. Telcos, especially, I mean, Mobile World Congress, you would be surprised at the conversations I was having with the telcos. It's like, I think that they understand that new devices are going to require them to have new ways of people to be able to connect these devices, right, and be able to process data. So yeah, I think it's going to be quite interesting.
But it's also potentially dystopian if it's not managed in the right way, right? Because it's not if these individual wearable recording devices are things that are enabling us and protecting us and, you know, essentially, you know, encouraging our humanity and our social behaviors in the positive way, then that's great. But if they're actually surveillance machines controlled by either a government or a massive corporation, you know, it's a completely different story. And so, I mean, and how important are things like NFTs and blockchain models, and how does that get, and is there an, are there enough people who are concerned about this who are actually working these solutions into that future?
I don't think there's that many people thinking about it, but I am having conversations in DC with legislation, with people on the Hill, with different parts of government. I'm like, obviously, blockchain, in my perspective, as an underlying architecture, can serve a great purpose, right? Especially with, you know, provenance and what is real, what isn't real, where did it come from, all these sorts of things, right? But then when you start to add that layer of the physical world, there is going to have to be some way to authenticate that what you're seeing is truly real, or that what you're seeing is truly what you should be seeing, right? I think there's some initial conversations being had. That's where I'm keeping my eye really close on all the AI regulation conversations that are happening. Even now, you're starting to see this trove of legislation and bills being passed at the state level.
Yeah,
that is about to cause a giant headache for these corporations. I mean, literally just today, and you probably have been following this, but because of rules in Texas, people in Texas can't access Pornhub. And I'm not making a judgment on the content. I'm not making this. I'm taking away all, you know, all like moral perspective here. It's more like from a tech perspective, right? So because of age gating, people in Texas can't access Pornhub. Well, Florida just passed HB SB3 or something like that, that restricts social media access to anyone 14 and younger, right? You have to be 14 and up, right? And with that, also there's age gating. So Pornhub right now is not accessible in Florida either. You have Tennessee passing the Elvis Act, which is about name, image, and likeness in AI and duplicating someone's voice. You're starting to see all these different states in the U.S. Enact laws that are going to eventually have to lead to somewhere of a federal law, because there's no way that these companies are going to be able to regulate that from the state level, right? Yeah. So that could happen with virtual air rights. I think keeping an eye on what you're seeing right now has an impact on the future of computing.
Yeah, and then you have things like the AI Act out of the EU, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's like all kinds of other things that are coming in. And for anyone who thinks the EU may not matter, I'll just remind you of GDPR, which is really the main reason have pop ups on your phone every 5 seconds. So I agree with you. I mean, look, I think you and I both know that, you know, part of the reason you're seeing so much state activity is the absence of anything being able to move at the federal level. And if, you know, if Congress could actually move more things through, I think you would see states being a little bit less proactive on these things. But it's interesting, because you're right. I mean, at the end of the day, the scope and scale of what these technologies could do is going to be mitigated by the sort of hoops and gates that they have to jump through, depending on if they're trying to be universal, if they're able to operate in these different ways in different states, which is really, really complicated and challenging to do all over the place. We see this in we've talked about this quite a bit on the show in terms of digital assets as well. It's the same thing here. It's just digital assets. the gating happens behind the scenes. Like there's cost to it and friction to it. Here, I mean, you literally cannot operate, you know, the business, yeah. right? It's just impossible.
How do you even do business? Like,
you can't.
It's gonna get really complicated. But I do think that those things that you're starting to see at the state level eventually come to the federal level, hopefully, right? And that might send some type of precedent, right? And then I'm looking at all the, you know, copyright and IP potential rulings coming down on AI. Like, how does that impact spatial computing? So I'm from my perspective, I'm trying to put all these things together and think about second and third order effects. And when I go to Capitol Hill and talk to, you know, to lawmakers, it's like, what does this mean for your constituents at the end of the day, mm-hmm. right? How does this impact their day-to-day lives? How does this impact their decisions, et cetera? So, it's a highly complicated moment we live in. Exciting from a technological perspective, but complicated for sure.
Well, I think there's a real emphasis now, which we didn't necessarily see in the first boom of the internet, around harm prevention or harm mm-hmm. reduction. And I certainly don't think that that is I'm certainly in favor of the impulse. The question is, how do you manifest that in ways that are actionable and meaningful, right? Because you can do all kinds of gating, like you say, all kinds of things that are not actually solving the problem of harm. And they're just kind of creating friction. And friction, you know, the introduction of friction, sometimes that helps, but usually it doesn't make any difference. There are workarounds to friction. There are all kinds of things that can be done. And we all know this, right? And if, you know, anybody who's ever watched a movie from the 80s and seen, you know, the kids climbing out the back window of the, you know, whatever, right? It's just like there's analog ways of getting around a lot
there's
of things.
Analog ways, yeah.
There's a lot of analog ways. So the idea that I think the instinct to kind of say, look, we are in a time when the science does show that there have been harm, especially to young people, from constantly being online, impulse control, like content, like all these kinds of things. That is true. I take that as true. I think it is evidence-based for sure. It's one of the reasons my kids don't have smartphones, for example, they're not online, like period, right? So that's true. And I think, the instinct to try to say, well, what is this next phase of possibility and possible harms? But again, that involves very deep technical understanding that, with all due respect, a lot of policymakers at whatever level
do not have. Yes. I will tell you, yes, many of them do not have that. Yeah. In different parts of the government, like I have this beef with like the patent office, which I'm like, sometimes I see some of the patents they approve. I'm like, this is a far-reaching patent, like a far overreaching patent. How are you even authorizing this? Like the person that authorized this might have some technical knowledge, but truly doesn't understand what they're authorizing here. So I think it's happening everywhere. Whenever I come across any of these laws now, the first thing that I ask myself is, how is this enforceable? Mm. How can you enforce this? How is this even enforceable? Right. And that's at the crux of like the Elvis Act in Tennessee and SB3 in Florida and like everything that's happening. Like, how is this even enforceable? It can only be enforceable if it gets to the federal level at the grander scheme of things. And that being said, I think it's such an important moment for anyone in Web3 and blockchain, because there is a chance to potentially create the solutions to help find solutions for these things, right? How do you do, you know, age gating in a way that might work? How do you do, provenance in a way that might work at a large scale for everyone? So you know, as much in doom and gloom as there is because Starbucks closes down their, you know, Odyssey thing, like, I'm like, that isn't the end all be all. At the end of the day, this technology needs to be helpful to humanity. Mm. And right now we are being forced to try to find solutions for this. That is an opportunity for anyone listening to this.
Yeah, like the wheels of government and policymaking in this context, trying to keep up with the speed of everything else, it's almost unfathomable that they could in a way. But yeah, we've got to come up with not just new models for how we do the compute and structure this thing, but actually literally how do we regulate and govern it. Okay, and unfortunately, this is, as I knew it would, Kathy, opened up a can of worms that could have taken us in all sorts of directions. Well, that's a strange mixed metaphor. Worms don't do that. But it's been great chatting. Before we go, you have Into the Metaverse was your book from a few years ago that people can read. But there's a new one coming out in May. Tell us about that quickly.
Yeah. And Into the Metaverse did great. And thank you to Consensus for having me there last year to do a book signing. It was fantastic. This year I have on May 14th, a book coming out by Wiley. It is called Spatial Computing, an AI-Driven Business Revolution. And it is focused on the convergence of AI, the moment that we're all seeing, with spatial computing, what comes next for the web, what comes next for computing, right? So it dives deep into that. I wrote it with Irina Cronin, who's very much an AI expert. I'm on the spatial computing side. I think we made a great combination bringing those two together. And I'm really excited about what's coming and being at the forefront of the next step. And once again, whether we call things metaverse or not, I do not care. I'm godmothering the expansion of computing, the expansion of the web here. And it is about hopefully designing things for humans at the end of the day.
All right. So on that very positive note, we're going to wrap it up. Thank you so much, Kathy Hackle. That was a wonderful conversation. This was Kathy Hackle, who's the co-founder of Journey. And as you've heard, if you've been listening, an expert in everything from emerging technologies, strategic advice on gaming, AR, AI, spatial computing, metaverse, Web3, you name it. She meets it all. And she is the godmother of the metaverse. So once again, thank you very much. Thank you to Sheila. Thank you to our tremendous producer, who we never thank enough, Michelle Musso, behind the scenes. Do come back next week for another edition of Money Reimagined, which you can catch every week on the CoinDesk Podcast Network, or you can find on Apple, Spotify, or any other podcast platforms. If you have some feedback, we always love to hear from you. Please share your thoughts at podcasts@coindesk.com using the subject line Money Reimagined. We do love hearing from you. I'm Michael Casey. Thank you so much for joining us. Bye-bye.